Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, editor-in-chief of the Science of Psychotherapy magazine, and I'm here with my illustrious editor and everything, Richard Hill. Howdy.
I'm illustrating here as you go. That's fantastic. Well, we do this like every week. We've got to make the introductions a bit different. So hello, everybody. It's lovely to be here, and it's great to actually this just shows, okay, we're going through this terrible trouble with being distanced. It's physical distance, not social distancing, because here we are talking to each other all around the world, and it's fantastic.
Right, yes, it is. So, Richard, today we are going back over to the United States to talk to one of our good friends, Terry Marks Tarlow. The people that have been following us for any length of time will know that she's been a contributor to The Neuropsychotherapist and The Science of Psychotherapy. And actually, just this week, a few weeks ago, because we're recording this ahead of time, she's published a two-hour course, Trauma and Psychotherapy, The Science of Trauma and Psychotherapy with Terry Marks Tarlow. And that is a two-hour certificate course that she's done here on our Academy platform. I'll put a link in the show notes for you there so you can catch her there.
Yeah, she's great. Quite brilliant. I've known Terry for about 10 years, I think, and we just got drawn together by her, the way her brain works, the way her mind works. I just love it. And so we've got her today to give us a bit of background.
Yes, so today we're getting Terry on to talk about a new book that she has co-authored called A Fractal Epistemology for a Scientific Psychology, Bridging the Personal with the Transpersonal.
Now, it's a heady title, I know, but it's an academic publisher at Cambridge, so they like those sort of things, this is what we're having this talk for now, because it actually is such interesting stuff.
Now, it is.
Tell us about her.
Well, Terry, she has written so much material. We'll have to send you to her biography on her website for all of that. But she's currently an adjunct faculty at the Pacifica Graduate Institute at California, the Institute for Integral Studies, as well as she's part of the core teaching faculty at the Insight Center in Los Angeles, where she conducts workshops and seminars. And she's written a stack of books, including the one we're going to talk about today, A Fractal Epistemology for a Scientific Psychology. She's done a wonderful coloring book, of all things, Awakening Clinical Intuition, an Experiential Workbook for Psychotherapists, Clinical Intuition in Psychotherapy, The Neurobiology of Embodied Response, Psyche's Veil, which we'll talk about in the podcast. So many. Again, we'll leave a list.
Yeah, so many things. She's written libretti for opera. She's curated art workshops. She dances. By golly, let's hear her talk for a little while.
Okay, let's go across and talk to Terry Marks Tarlow. So Terry Marks Tarlow, thank you very much for joining us once again on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing as well as can be expected in this climate, and I thank you both so much for inviting me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, hello from me. It's great to see you again. You're looking as cheery and joyous as ever.
Well, thank you, Richard.
We were keen to get you on the show at this time because you've got yet another book out that you've co-authored with a bunch of people. So A Fractal Epistemology for a Scientific Psychology. Sounds like an intriguing title, as most of your titles are. And so I thought we might be able to scratch the surface. I'm pretty sure that's all we can do in the time that we have, and have a little bit of a chat about it.
Well, as we'll see, the fractal work, scratching the surface, is sometimes all you need. But this isn't new, and I know we want to jump into the book, but I just want to remind people, Terry, that this isn't like something you thought of yesterday. No. One of your first books, going back a year or seven, was, again, titled Fractals and Talking in There. So this is a continuation of work that you've been doing for some time. I'm very interested to hear about where you've taken things now.
Yes, it's true. My first book Psyche's Veil.
Psyche's Veil, that's right.
Yes, was about this. And many of the illustrations in this new book are from that. It's just, this is such a different way of viewing the world that I keep uncovering new layers of meaning for it. And the title, the Fractal Epistemology for Scientific Psychology, is really based on Freud's project for a scientific psychology. So his intention of having psychology be a neurology, he wasn't able to do at the time. But this is a little different than the brain. Of course, I'm interested in interpersonal neurobiology, and I have been talking with you and providing materials to you on interpersonal neurobiology. But this is a little different because math, in some ways, is deeper than science. Since the empirical method and all of science rests on mathematics as a foundation. And so this is taking the mathematics and using that to look at the world differently, literally look at the world differently. And I do believe that once people understand what a fractal is, that they cannot step outside and see the world the same way. It's just everything is fractal in nature, and this is the mathematics, the geometry of nature, as Middlebrot originally, that was his manifesto, was called the Fractal Geometry of Nature, and it is a totally synthetic and holistic way of looking at the world. And I think we need that in psychology.
Yes. Can I start with two very bold statements that you make in this new book? And maybe you could speak to that. The first one is, as a collective, you say that we believe that the mathematics of fractals is rich and robust enough to model the most complex psychological phenomena, which corresponds to the Mandelbrot set, as the most complicated mathematical object known to humankind. And then you further go on to say that you believe that nonlinear science broadly and fractal geometry specifically provide a holistic, flexible meta-framework for understanding even the most complex psychological, social, cultural, and historical systems. So it sounds like the fractal geometry is the answer to the universe.
Before
you get into the complexity of it or the detail of it, perhaps we might need to just actually give a sort of an overview of what we mean by the word fractal.
Oh, yeah. What is a fractal?
Okay. Let's just start with that one, if you would be so kind.
Okay, sure. Very, very simply, I think the meta framework is because fractal geometry is the patterning of patterns in nature. So a fractal is a pattern where the pattern of the whole is reflected in the pattern of the parts. And the parts can be either in space, so that it's smaller and larger scale, or over time, so that it's a repeating pattern over time. And it's holistic because the pattern of the whole is in the pattern of the parts. So we normally think of parts as combining to make wholes, but here wholes are used to make parts.
Right.
Could you just explain, you talk about where, you know, kids drawing a tree and the difference between using
Euclidean. Euclidean geometry. Yes. So Euclidean geometry has influenced how we see the world for thousands of years. And that's those simple shapes of triangles and squares and circles. And so when we were in grammar school, we played with making a tree by cutting out the different shapes and pasting them together. So we take a little rectangle for the base of the tree and maybe a triangle for what the tree looks like. But if we had played instead with fractals, we would have done it differently. So a pine tree, for example, we would take maybe a triangle, and then we take a smaller triangle, like this would be a Christmas tree sort of looking thing, and then a smaller yet triangle, and we would stack them together and play with the same shape that is on different size scales. And kids do that intuitively. And so in all of my books, I think, in all of my chapters on fractal geometry, I take the little heart people that my daughter drew at about age 5, where she took a large heart and she made daddy and slightly smaller and made mommy slightly smaller and actually made herself and then the smallest her brother, although she's younger than her brother. And so that's an interesting twist on playing with these shapes. But I think kids do naturally play with these shapes universally as a stage of art because they're very intuitive. And it is actually how our mind works intuitively.
Yes, there was the one that I remember seeing was a mountain range. And they just divided that or created that and showed that it was just a series of triangles of various mm-hmm. sizes, but also triangles within triangles, and that you could sort of, a little bit simplistic, but you were able to see it all as just a various expression of sizes and time frames, because of course the mountain range went along a space. Is that's the sort of thing that we're talking about?
Yes, exactly. And you can make a very, very realistic mountain range starting with a simple triangle and then using smaller ones and bending them in various directions in shape and in space and replacing sides with ever smaller ones. And everybody would recognize a fractal animation in the movies because all of animation that looks realistic these days is based on using fractals to render. So it's completely realistic looking when these things are done on the computer.
So how do we go from shapes and these visual things that we talk about with fractal geometry to something as complex as our psychology?
Mm-hmm. So one really interesting thing about fractal geometry has to do with boundaries and boundary conditions. And that's what I've been focusing on a lot lately, because we tend to think of boundaries like in terms of the Descartesian splits, for example, Cartesian splits, where inner and outer it's very clean and smooth, and we have slowly been erupting this idea that, for example, mind and body have a smooth kind of boundary like that, or mind and brain. And so this kind of geometry models a very, very different kind of boundary that is rough, bumpy, and paradoxical, and even interpenetrating at the edges, which means that the totality of both sides is there at the edge. And so in psychology, when we work with the complexity of people, we either have ambiguity, we have a lot of ambiguity, or we have a lot of paradox, like we have a lot of simultaneous opposites going on. Sometimes those opposites, like from the Jungian psychology, we might consciously express one thing and then unconsciously be holding the opposite, for example. And so to be able to model how those opposites can coexist at the same time at the boundaries is very, very different than our normal sense of boundary. Plus, how we see the boundaries is observer dependent, mm-hmm. and meaning that what we see depends how we look at the boundaries. And so that is certainly those of us who are therapists, what we see depends on who's looking and how we look. And so these qualities that we intuitively understand as clinicians and this level of complexity, for example, if I might say that I have a cartoon where she's dreaming about him dreaming about her. And this would be a kind of internalized objects. So object relations theory is all about internalizing the other. And this models that kind of recursive patterning. So that's the other thing, is that the fractals model recursive patterning. And one of the things in psychoanalytic literature is that we talk a lot about patterns, interpersonal patterns, but they've never been really described. And this recursiveness, or self-reflexive patterning and self-reflexive symmetry, is really how it all works psychologically.
Right.
So, yeah. So one of the paradoxes is that the boundaries can be both open and closed at the same time. And when we think about people, this is true too. Dan Siegel talks about the mind extending beyond the body, extending out into the world. And many of us talk about the body, the mind being in the body as well, or the brain being all the way distributed through the body. And so to have boundaries that are both open and closed, we might think about that psychologically as we are both autonomous, so that we're self-contained on the one hand, but we're relational beings with social brains on the other hand. And so that's an openness to others, and it's a way that our consciousness is distributed relationally. And yeah, so that's the kind of paradox that
And it's a testing thing when we look, because there's a tendency in the way people are trained with psychology and psychotherapy and therapeutic work, is that there's this and that, this is good, that's not so good, and we're trying to get at what's not so good and get to what's good. Like there's a reductionism towards a single sort of beneficial state, as different from this, as you're saying, that these states can coexist successfully.
Yes, and what you're describing is actually dualistic thinking. You know, it's either or, it's good or bad, it's black or white. And so this is a non-dual. That's one of the benefits in transpersonal psychology, for example. Where they're very interested in expanded states of consciousness that and non-dualistic thinking. And so this is a way of eliminating that either-or kind of quality or good or bad. It's good and bad. It's a mixture of both sides.
One of the things that just sort of rewinding just a little bit that was fascinating to me as I was reading some of your chapters in this book was that these simple self-replicating patterns, they are simple patterns when we're talking about fractal geometry. And yet what comes out of it, and I was in almost like a trance state watching some of these videos where you're zooming in on these repeating patterns, it's so beautiful and complex and organic looking, and yet the patterns and the formula that describes the pattern is very, very simple.
Yes, the formula is so simple and the output is so complex that that formula as iterated on the computer on the complex number plane is the most complex mathematical object in the world, you know, in the universe, as far as we know.
Yeah.
So it is incredibly complex and non-repeating. And that's the other thing, is the way that there is self-similarity, meaning there is an approximation of a repetition, but it's always new. And I do encourage the listeners to look at Mandelbrot Zooms on the internet. There are a lot of them, and they go very deep, and they're beautiful, and they are transfixing. It's like having a psychedelic trip, and those people who have taken LSD or hallucinogens might recognize some of the imagery from that. And in fact, one of the chapters in the book is about the relationship between hallucinations under psychedelics and these patterns.
Yeah, this is something I found very interesting too in your work and also in previous work. I've done the nature of what we call hallucinations and hallucinogens, particularly with LSD and things, is actually a removal of the padding around the patterns. And I can imagine, when we're talking about the mountain range, the triangles, that as well as anything could have been someone on a nice little LSD trip saying, "Oh wow, man, look, they're all triangles." But it is what happens. That Aldous Huxley was trying to find this sort of stuff in some of this work that he was doing. How can I find the fundamental frames? And there's been a lot of wafting about this stuff, and now you're coming down and not making it again, reducing it, making it specific, but actually giving us the capacity to say, no, it is an actual functional, doable, manageable, and inspiring thing.
Yes, and organic. And not only that, I think it's profound also, and that's the profundity is another paradox of it, because it injects an infinite dimension between finite dimensions. And so some people define God in terms of infinity, and so there is this amazing feeling of it being just profound and liminal. And it does, like consciousness has that feeling too of having an infinite expansion, that piece of it, the infinite dynamic of it and expandability of it is just breathtaking.
Yeah. Now to bring once again bringing this back to psychotherapy. Now, you talk a lot about dreams, dream state, and how the fractal geometry sort of informs you about dreams. So could you talk a little bit about how you work with people with dreams?
Yeah, I think dreams that's a really good example of an application, because many people think a dream, if we can analyze a dream fully, that it captures the whole of the psyche in a moment. And so that in itself is a kind of a fractal quality, would be to the degree that taking a dream and going into it reveals the whole of things. And then when we look at a dream and we come back and we look again and we get new meaning out of it, there's another way that's a recursive way of looking at a dream, and a very dynamic way of looking at a dream, a very observer-dependent way of looking at a dream, that each time we bring new things into a dream, we get new things out, and that's infinitely deep. Also, the idea that we can start with a tiny piece of something and get to the whole through that piece. So that's the dream is a tiny piece of our psyche that gives us a flashlight or provides illumination of the whole. And also, it's, I think, interesting that dreams share the same perceptual reality as our day life. It's, the REM state really is pretty identical to the everyday perceptual state, but we're learning more and more how we consolidate learning through dreams. And so it's a very special way that we're building growth into our brains, and to have there be this fractal piece to it is there's a researcher who I'm trying to remember his name, Carl Anderson, I believe, at Harvard, who looks at dream states of sheep fetuses, because all mammalian fetuses spend their pretty much entire states in REM, and infants have much more REM, they sleep a lot, and then slowly over time that reduces. But he looks at how fractals may take us from the micro level of neurons all the way up through consciousness. And so self-similarity can go from a single neuron up the levels, upscaling up to consciousness. So
Is this what you refer to as fractal consciousness? You talk about fractal consciousness.
That's a little differently.
Oh, okay.
That's a little different, because that's more the cascading up, and the cascading up from a single thing all the way to the large scale emergence in mm-hmm. consciousness. Is more like chaos theory, and how tiny little differences can cascade through self-similarity up into huge differences. So, for example, a single interpretation that hits the mark in psychotherapy can change the entire course of treatment. That would be an example of a cascading up from a tiny scale up to a global scale. But when I talk about fractal consciousness, really what I'm meaning is how intuition works by taking a tiny slice of experience and revealing the whole. So when we first meet somebody, we just get so much information about that person intuitively, and there are all sorts of analytic statements that say, you know, the first session presages the entire course of treatment, the first minute of an hour, of an analytic hour, presages the entire hour. And so this idea that we can get a sense of the whole of a person through just the tiniest slice of contact is what I mean by fractal consciousness. And it sort of makes sense that nature would work that way, that would be more like right brain intuition versus left brain analysis. So if we're in our analytic side, this is not fractal consciousness. This is more what Richard was talking about, of a reductive way of thinking, where we're trying to figure out stuff. We're trying to break down our experience and figure it out. And that's the opposite of having an instant contact and then having a sense of the whole. For example, if we get a sense of danger, for example, if we meet someone and our intuition is on, we're sensing the whole of the person, and we're having an emotional response. And I think emotion and relational dynamics, emotional dynamics are what is accessible to this fractal consciousness.
I'm just thinking up with the mirror neuron process and taking sort of really going back to what Rizzolatti said, that it gives us an innate sense of the other person's movement capacity. And that I think is this. I'm feeling that's in that same frame. That what we do is we can very quickly get this innate sense of capacity, which then expands out from that simple expression. Is that
That's a really good example, and it's not just motor capacity. Mirror neurons give us a sense of people's intentionality.
That's right. Out of that, and that emerges out of from one thing emerges. So intentionality,
it's part of it, right?
And things are all fractally related.
It's relate right. It's related to having a sense of the whole of the person, and so having an unconscious sense of people's intentionality is a very global sense of what's going on, you know. And yeah, that's a good example of a very holistic function that's automatic and natural, and we don't think twice about it. It just happens, but all these ways that these very holistic operations are going on unconsciously, and now this is a tool for making that the holism of that much more conscious.
Yeah, and kind of we're the ones that do the mistake of naming it and containing it and calling one bit movement capacities and one bit intentionality and one bit. Actually, it's all there in the first place. It's just us dummies take a little while to get it.
That's right. And it's an illusion when we pull it out of context. I really like McGilchrist's way of describing that difference, where that analytic side of ourselves pulls things out of context. And so overly reduces and simplifies in a way that just isn't, it's a map, it isn't the territory. This is a description of the territory.
Listen, that's good. Yeah. Me too, Matt. I'm doing the same thing.
So I'm thinking as a psychotherapist, well, first of all, you started to answer the question, where is this science going in terms of informing psychotherapy? And you've also said in the book, as well as you've studied this for many years, and yet you say you still don't fully understand the complexity of this sort of this fractal geometry. But I'm wondering, for all the psychotherapists out there, what are your hopes for this informing our practice?
Yeah, I just quickly. Yes. Yeah, I want to just to inform it a little bit more. There's a wonderful quote I read from Einstein, because I know you say you don't understand, and that's very generous, but the beautiful quote from Einstein, he said, the difference between genius and stupidity is that genius knows it has limitations.
Right.
So when you say I don't understand, this is your kindness to the grandness of the topic, because I would like to suggest that the reason you've written this book is because you're one of the most understanding people that I know in the world. I don't know everybody, but I know quite a lot of people.
Yes. Thank you. I really appreciate this. Yes.
Sorry, Matt, back to your question. Yeah.
Well, and just riffing on that for a second, wisdom has been defined that way too. And I do think that in a way, the whole infinitely expandable domain of this makes it impossible to understand. Understanding really, as you say, names and contains, and this does the opposite of that, and so it's more connected to spirituality in that way, and wisdom in that way, or I suppose genius as well, in terms of the understanding there that we are too limited to fully grasp. So I do appreciate that. Thank you.
Now back to the practice room.
Back to the relevance to psychotherapy. I think there's both an ordinary and an extraordinary relevance. I think the ordinary one is that we can look at relational patterns. So, for example, when we are working with somebody and we want to work relationally, then we hear the stories that our patients tell us about their relationships in the world, and then we observe how those dynamics are coming into play in the transference. Well, that's a recursive patterning. That's where what's going on in the outer in the outer world is now recursively reflected in our relationship. And if we're in supervision, we might find the same dynamic happening there at another level too. And so transference and countertransference dynamics can be understood as this kind of recursive patterning. Mm-hmm. And repetition compulsion is a good example as well. And that's a less relational idea, but that's the idea that our patients are repeating the same thematic patterns in the world. I think Bowlby's working, internal working models, those are relational patterns that we can now recast as recursively enfolded patterning that we keep articulating, and then it gets over time, developmentally, it gets refined, it gets more sophisticated, hopefully it gets more complex with age, with development, with experience, with greater and greater context that we bring to it. And so it does change and evolve. Now, if it doesn't evolve, if it's perfectly a repetition, it's more pathological than if it does evolve. Mm. But okay. So as metaphor and working with people, here are a couple of examples where we can introduce fractals as a metaphor that help patients understand, for example, that our issues never go away. They're always there, no matter what we do. But if we keep dynamically moving them, then they might look very differently in the same way that branches of a tree, for example, the branching structure is probably one of the most organically common patterns. And so the branching structure of, like, when you take a V of a branch and then each branch branches some more and then branches some more and it gets tinier and tinier. So an addict, for example, may have the same urges, may always be an addict, but if that person is no longer practicing the addiction, it looks very different on the surface. And so it's the pattern that is getting to tinier and tinier scales all the time, or more and more sophisticated levels. And even though it's the same pattern, it's completely different. So people might say, how do I know I should stop therapy? Because there are always new things that come up. And this helps with that we, yes, things always come up, and yes, these issues recur, but we can deal with them very differently and on tinier scales. And even though our feelings might be very similar when they do come up, it doesn't mean we're not making progress. So this is a way of showing progress, even though the issue is similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sort of seeing that just using that example there of the addict, he has a fractal pattern of a type of engagement with in the holism. But is it reasonable to say that actually the addiction is just a collapsing of the fractal expansion or the fractal potential into addiction? That what it is that what you're saying is you can carry that pattern and that capacity and that potential. It doesn't have to collapse into addiction. It can go into various things and be changing constantly. Yes. That's also yes. What you're saying.
Yes, well, a good way of looking at where fractals are the realm of complexity, and fractals exist between the realm of rigidity on the one hand and complete chaos or being ordered on the other hand. And so absolutely every form of pathology is a restriction of that complexity, either a restriction of the complexity or an opening into too much disorder on the other hand. So I would agree that sort of repetition, the addiction, is a collapsing of complexity.
Okay, interesting.
And yeah, and health, I mean, this turns the idea of what's healthy completely on its head, because we used to think regularity and stability were the markers of health, but actually it's variability, adaptability, and the capacity to pull out what you need in the moment based on what's coming up. And so, so hopefully the addict in making progress restores that variability and the complexity.
Yeah. I'm starting to use the word possibility a lot. I'm writing something about it now, but just in that same framework. I mean, I hope to think I'm somewhere in there. Get the stuff you're doing, but and this idea that you can take the elements, and those elements are informing you they're not constraining you to the elements. They're actually enabling you. So every little bit of knowledge you have actually enables you to open up to an unimaginable amount of stuff. And the fractal, this explains it.
Yes, and there's another way that I said there was sort of some ordinary ways of using it and some more extraordinary ways. And when Matt, you were asking about the dream possibilities, the chapter in the Fractal Epistemology book, the second one I did on dreams and synchrony and synchronicity, looks at relational sharing, unconscious relational sharing, and that is some extraordinary stuff. I'm also writing a paper right now for Psychoanalytic Dialogues with one of the book's co-editors, Jakob Shapiro, on synchronicity and dreams and a causal connection. And so examples of us as therapists being able to access things from the unconscious of our patients, whether through dreams, like transference dreams, for example, that are precognitive, and just there's the whole realm of uncanny knowing. And if there is a fractal boundary, both between our own conscious and unconscious levels, so that we can move in both directions, things from consciousness appear in dreams, and things emerge from the unconscious through imagination into our conscious minds. If that's got a fractal boundary, but then if our own unconscious and the unconscious of our patients has a fractal boundary, then that also can interpenetrate, and we can now normalize what's been marginalized in the past in extraordinary ways in which we run in synchrony with our patients, and that running in synchrony winds up helping us intimately connect at these deep levels and then have these events of unconscious sharing that are so extraordinary, and people don't always want to talk about them because it's been considered ascientific, and now we can model it.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking as a scientific foundation for our conceptualization of mental health, there's something about this which is very liberating.
Mm. Yes. I think.
Yeah.
It's very liberating. Because even the idea of what's normative is a false idea. That's based on a linear statistic, and it's on reducing variability to a central tendency that doesn't exist in real life. And so, you know, for example, I remember when I was younger and there was a statistic floating around that the average American family has 2.5 children, which I'm like, how do you have a half a child? It's like no family has that. Not a single family has that. And so normative statistics it's crazy making, you know, it reduces the variability. And another paradoxical piece with the fractal is that the closer you look at a fractal, the more there is to see. And that is how people, that's what Richard, you're talking about of the opening up, is the more there is to see, not the less there is to see. And so, for example, if we, you know, if I looked at depression as just a thing that I understand totally, then if I, every depressed person, I'll just reduce them to the same formula. But in truth, I'm only going to be a good therapist if every time I look at a depressed person, I'm going to see a world of difference between each one. And so this thing about opening up is so important as opposed to closing down.
I think fantastic.
Now we're getting to that time, Terry, but I'm just hearing that last comment and what it leaves people with, this idea of the sense of coming down to something and then treating to something down as different from using it as the indicator and as a stimulus and as a, now we can talk as a fractal framework on which to expand. And that then gives us that wonderful Ericksonian thing where every single therapy is unique to the individual.
And this is why this
book explains it. Yeah. Now, is there any last thing you just want to say? I mean, that's a beautiful thing to leave off with, but is there any last thing you want to sort of wrap up the discussion with?
I think anything would be dwarfed after that.
I think so,
you're pointing, you know, that points to the infinite, that points to the spiritual dimension, and I guess maybe that piece of it is the way this points to the spiritual dimension is the piece that is fascinating me now, and how the sacred is actually in the profane rather than in a different realm, and how they're mixed together. So that's I think that's why the second part of the title, the bridging of the personal with the transpersonal, this is the transpersonal piece, and I think that is just fascinating and awesome in the literal sense of the word.
And that will be our next discussion. But for now, Matt, we just got to thank Terry. And
it's been fascinating. So in the spirit of liberating us all by using mathematics, didn't think mathematics would liberate me, but maybe it will. We'll point everybody to a fractal Epistemology for a Scientific Psychology, this latest book by Terry Marks Tarlow. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being able to talk with you.
Thanks, Terry. See you next time. Actually, there was some pretty heady stuff in there, but what a way to end. I just think when it all boils down, this expansive, engaged possibility of life is so natural and true. And Terry has just given us a framework through the reality of mathematics. Mathematicians think we're all stupid going into all these other things. They think the world's the most magical, joyous place. So don't be frightened by it, as we do. We think, oh, mathematics, that's a stereotype threat. I can tell you all about that later. It's the joy of understanding the greatness of what we live in and what we can do as therapists. This is what I think we're going to get out of this book and out of this talk today.
Absolutely. And if I can just reiterate what I said in the podcast, that this scientific understanding, this mathematical scientific understanding, as a foundation of what we understand in terms of mental health and psychotherapy, it really is liberating. It really is. It gives us a new foundation, new in my mind, from which then to build therapeutic practice and conceptualization from, which is very different to maybe what we've studied in the past.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about, you know, sort of what's wrong with therapy and why does therapy not work or why do therapists not get better? And maybe it's just because we don't think the right way. We've been taught a way of thinking. Now, I wonder if it is possible for us to think a different way, and in doing so, take what we know and actually make it something more. So rather than having to throw everything out and bring everything new, maybe it's just a redoing Anyway, let's listen to this. Let's read this book. Let's expand our continue to expand our conversations, which we will do again next week. But for now, I think we're done.
We'll do again next week because there's recursive patterns in what you and I both do.
That's right. It's a recursive pattern. That's what we are.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us here at the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Looking forward to catching you next week.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.